Hurry up and wait to vote in Florida. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, where we discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making headlines. A review of voting in the 2012 election finds Florida voters waited in line far longer than any other state, more than a half hour. Why? And what's being done to address it ahead of this election day? Documents released with a new book this week show the U.S. considered attacking Cuba in the mid-1970s after secret meetings trying to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations failed and Cuba sent troops to Africa. And preparing for higher seas, ahead of next week's King Tide, local efforts on Miami Beach get some national attention. But will that attention turn into action? All ahead on the Florida Roundup next. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. 2 years ago this election day, voting in several South Florida communities, 4 years ago this election day, rather, voting in several South Florida communities was an exercise in patience. Lines were long, the sun was hot, and some voters waited until after midnight on election night to cast their ballots.
The line was ridiculous. It went all the way up to Scotty's Landing, and I was not going to stand in line for 5 or 6 hours in the heat.
That's Phil Rosenfeld. It was in 2012, 2 years ago, that he went to Miami City Hall to vote early. Twice. Both times he turned around. Many of the longest lines in that 2012 election cycle happened to be in southern Miami-Dade County, where Republican David Rivera and Democrat Joe Garcia were fighting for Florida's 26th congressional district seat. Now, Garcia won the election, but due to the long wait times, he gave his victory speech while constituents were still waiting to vote.
It is unpardonable what happened. You know, you build train tracks into a wall, and then you're surprised when the train runs into it. People have been warning the governor about this for a long time, and the governor said everyone would get to vote. People voting at midnight on a night of an election, this is the most advanced country in the world. We can make good decaf coffee and we can put a man on the move. We can make people vote a little bit easier.
That was 2 years ago. This week, ahead of another election day, the federal government's Government Accountability Office released a study finding Florida voters endured the longest wait times to vote 2 years ago. And we won that distinction by a landslide. 34 minutes on average to vote in the Sunshine State in 2012. 1 in 6 in Florida waited more than an hour. Florida U.S. Senator Bill Nelson called the report troubling.
This is America. This is America in the year 2014. We shouldn't be having to deal with this. We shouldn't be having to ask the General Accounting Office, an arm of the United States Congress, for a report.
But yet, it was asked for the report. The report came out this week. How long did you wait to vote 2 years ago? Was it too long? Are you discouraged by Florida's voting laws and voting practices? Let us know by joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. You can email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org. Follow us on Twitter, @WLRN is the handle. Look for us on Facebook or go directly online at WLRN.org. Laura Wides-Munoz follows politics and other things Florida for the Associated Press. She's along with us here in studio. Sergio Bustos, political editor at the Miami Herald as well. Sergio, why, first of all, the wait times in Florida that were identified this week?
Why is always a very difficult question because it seems like every other state has figured it out. This report is especially difficult because or tough on Florida because this is from the Government Accountability Office, which is the congressional watchdog. Mm-hmm. These are the auditors for the for Congress, so it's pretty serious.
Very serious, although greeted with tin ears at this point, Laura. I mean, what kind of action do we anticipate to come out of it?
Well, I think that there are, at least on the nonprofit side and the nonpartisan side, a lot of groups have taken notice and are really pushing to do absentee ballot, to get people out early. I know I was up in Polk County a few weeks ago, and you had young kids going door to door, trying to get folks who voted historically or at least have been registered to make sure that they could send their ballots in. But, you know, the days are counting down for the early election, so it's getting tight.
October 20th is when early voting begins. October 20th is when it begins. And Sergio, one of the challenges that was identified by this report was how much early voting was able to happen. And we know there had been restrictions in the past on early voting, for instance, early Sunday voting before Election Day. But some of those has been addressed in the latest legislative session in Florida. Is it fixed?
Well, you'd hope it's fixed. And then I thought we'd be maybe reporting this story in November when the election came around. And short of moving to Alaska, where I understand the wait time is 1.4 minutes, or maybe sending our canvassers to Alaska to learn how they do this. But I will mention this in terms of looking ahead. I don't think this legislation is going to pass, but, and I hate to borrow an expression, but this is the true name of the legislation by Senator Bill Nelson. It's called Lines Interfere with the National Elections Act of 2014. It's called the Line Act. They're trying to make it so that if there's a problem with early, with long wait lines, that there would be a remedial plan to minimize voter waiting times through this legislation. But, you know, as Laura says, you're looking at less than a month of the election, so this legislation has really little chance of doing anything, even if it did pass.
You know, some of the other identifiers in terms of the pinch points, Laura, that were identified in this report from the 2012 election cycle, the check-in process, which is, I wouldn't call it onerous, but it's very involved here in Florida. I mean, as long as nobody's at the polling place, and certainly that was the case in many places during the primary, very quick to go through. And then also the type of ballot and the voting equipment, the technology involved in all this.
Right. And remember, we, you know, in Florida, we have, at least down here in Miami, we have it in three languages, which makes a very long ballot because we have it in Creole, Spanish, and English. And, you know, it strikes me that there are places where I vote, for example, it's almost always empty. So the question is, does there need to be a reevaluation of where people are being sent to man the ballots and maybe even having the ability to move them throughout the day very quickly and mobilize a little bit more rapidly in that sense.
Yeah. How much can we expect election commissioners to respond to problems that are cropping up at 10 a.m. on election day versus just responding 2 years after the fact, Sergio, like we got with this report? I think the question remains, is this yet another, how much of this report is another indication of a very troubling systematic problem in Florida voting that dates back at least to 2000 with the Hanging Chads, if not prior to that?
Oh, it's a very troubling thing. I mean, again, as Senator Nelson says, it, you know, it's a constitutional right to vote that people are having to wait, you know, such a long time to do. On the other hand, you know, what always strikes me every time we do this process, every election cycle, I'm always amazed that there's long wait lines at certain precincts.
Right.
Yet those historically have had a lot of people at them. So you'd figure, okay, if you're a business and you're getting a lot of traffic at one store and not the other, you would bring more clerks and salespeople to the busy store and leave the other one aside. But I don't think that message or that strategy seems to come into play.
And Sergio, there is some socioeconomic correlation between the ones that tend to be more busy and more backup.
What are those? Do we know? Sergio?
Well, what happens is, especially during early voting, in some of these precincts where they have a large share of minority voters, there may be a tendency there to kind of cut back or at least not have as many folks there. Or sometimes things are changed in terms of the precinct itself and the information doesn't get out quick enough. It's just again, a series of problems and missteps that happen. But again, this is something you prepare for every 2 years, and we have, what, maybe a primary and a general election? Right. It seems like, and this GAO report reaffirms, it seems like something needs to get done and to get Florida along with the rest of the country, which seems to not have a problem with this.
And one interesting thing is the push for absentee ballots that would alleviate the lines. On the flip side, I heard a number of people say, I like to go to the polls. I want to see who's voting. I want to do my civic duty. And that's historically been a part, especially for people who were turned away under Jim Crow, to be able to go and cast your ballot. Yeah. And so I don't think that absentee ballots is really the answer in the way we want to go with civic participation.
And we know that early voting is limited in terms of locations as well. Not everybody can get to the limited places where early voting is allowed. But it does get to a broader sense. You mentioned Alaska, which had the shortest average wait times of under 2 minutes. But who wants to stand out in Alaska November day, quite frankly, waiting to vote versus standing out in the Miami hot sun. But somewhere between Alaska's under 2 minutes and Florida's over a half hour, what should voters expect if they're going to their polling place on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, Laura?
Well, how long do you wait in Walmart, you know, for your party decorations and your weekly grocery? And this is something you do every 2 years, if not every 4 years, it's your civic duty. So hopefully people are willing to wait at least 10 minutes. I think a quarter of those government officials who reported back said 10 minutes was too long to wait.
Yeah.
you know, I guess that's a personal thing. A half an hour, 45 minutes seems a long time, especially if you're trying to encourage voter turnout.
How about Sergio? How long is too long?
Well, Tom, Nelson's legislation would make it, I guess they're following the Domino's pizza model, that you should get to vote within 30 minutes or less. Or, I don't know, you get to pick your own candidate. Yeah, I don't know what you do.
Your second topping is free, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Listen, we'll go from pizzas to wedding dresses now. This week, in the race for governor, Charlie Crist had a big hitting visitor here in Miami-Dade County, the former First Lady, a former U.S. Senator, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The latest GOP ad for Rick Scott, meantime, imitates reality TV and has brought with it plenty of criticism. This is the ad from College Republican National Committee. It's a spoof on the reality TV show Say Yes to the Dress. Now, get ready for this. The ad features a bride-to-be choosing between two wedding dresses, actual wedding dresses. The names of those wedding dresses are correlated to the two major party gubernatorial candidates here.
Budget is a big deal for me now that I just graduated from college.
The Rick Scott is perfect.
Rick Scott is becoming a trusted brand. He has new ideas that don't break your budget.
But mom has other ideas.
I like the Charlie Crist. It's expensive and a little out.
Well, so now we're aliking our gubernatorial candidates, our future governors, and I guess in this case, former governors, to wedding dresses. This was this ad from the College National Republican Committee, an unapologetic spoof on a reality TV show. Democrats blasted this ad as sexist. Does it go anywhere, Laura?
I can't even comment on this, Ad. I'm sorry. I'm just going to pass on this one, except to simply say I think it matters a tiny bit more who our governor is than what dress you pick out, as important as that is to many people.
Yeah. Is this an opportunity missed for young Republicans, Sergio?
I don't know. I was going to go with Laura. I'm glad she didn't kick it to me. I was going to say I can't dignify this with a response. But, you know, it's one of those things where they're always trying to reach the young voter. And I think it was just in 2008 with Obama that he brought out the younger voters. Mm-hmm. In 2012, they came out again. But, you know, this is an off-year election, presidential year at least. You know, it's not a presidential election. So there's always efforts made, whether it's doing this. I remember a couple years ago, I think they had keg parties all over
right.
the state.
Let's give it the benefit of the doubt. You've got 20%, something like 20% turnout of 18 to 24-year-olds.
Right.
This is Hail Mary. Let's do anything we can to pull folks out. I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt.
Well, that's the next question is, how much does Scott need young Republicans to show up in November?
Obviously, he needs all Republicans because this is a real race about getting out the base. I know it's a cliche, but it's very true. Winning these independents is always going to be harder because they're going to make up their minds later. But if they can, if Chris can get the base out in South Florida with Democrats, it'll do well for him because Sink did not do that in 2010.
Alex Sink, the gubernatorial candidate four years ago, right? Laura, meantime, a week from today, we have the first gubernatorial debate. It will be in English, but it's for a Spanish language audience. Talk to us about how important that audience is going to be for these two candidates.
Well, I think it's very important, and I think, you know, it's interesting to note while Democrats, you know, overwhelmingly voted, Latinos overwhelmingly voted for Obama in the Florida elections, much more up for grab on state races. And I think the Scott campaign, together with the state GOP party, have put out 7 ads in mm-hmm. Spanish so far. Democrats have done 1. On the flip side, Democrats have been opening offices in places they never have before, Apopka, places like that with the Latino base. The question is how much outreach there really will be. There was a huge drop of Latinos back in 2010, down from 2008. On the other hand, as we were discussing, the participation of Latinos in Florida in 2008 was very high.
What was the number in 2008?
In 2008, Latinos participated, of those who were citizens who could vote, 61%, which was higher than the African-American community in Florida, which was at 53%. So there was a bigger drop, but they had an over-representation, you could say, early on. And back in 2012, it was back up, you know, to 62%. So, you know, down from 41%. Yeah. So that will be the real test. With the growing numbers of Latinos, Puerto Ricans, who can, of course, already vote if they choose, but are underrepresented generally in this state. Are they going to get out the boat? Both campaigns are working very heavily in the I-4 corridor, and we'll see what their results are.
Right, which has grown considerably in terms of its influence on the Hispanic vote here. Finally, I have to ask you both, as veteran watchers of Florida politics, the comments on the Rolling Stone article that was published this week online, headlined "The Florida Farce: Rick Scott versus Charlie Crist." Very negative on, quite frankly, both candidates. It seems to me, Sergio, that once a year Rolling Stone has to dump on Florida one way or the other. A year ago, it was Miami is going to sink into the ocean. This year, it's calling our gubernatorial race a farce.
Yes, I think it's become we're a punching bag for the rest of the country in that sense. Some of it deserved, some of it undeserved. Look, this campaign has all been about negativity, and even the polls that have been done over and over again show voters or the people polled are saying we'll go for the lesser of the ones we like. Their favorability ratings are really low. It's a very negative campaign, not surprising.
Laura?
I think that a lot has been focused on the negativity, but I think, you know, the Rolling Stone article and much of the coverage, and that's us as well, fails to capture the fact there are distinct differences between the two candidates. Charlie Crist was in our office this week for a roundtable discussion with the AP. We did invite Governor Scott. He has declined to come. And he talked about, vetoing, for example, more funding for charter schools if there's not greater oversight to make sure they're really performing as well as they should be. Things like that matter. Judicial appointments matter. So the notion that it's sort of between, you know, mauve and off-white, I think those are the same colors, you know, is a little inadequate.
A little inadequate, right. Another issue that hasn't gotten a whole lot of discussion is the environment, something we'll talk about later on in this program here on the Florida Roundup. Sergio Bustos, political editor at the Miami Herald, Laura Wise-Munoz with the Associated Press. I'm Tom Hudson, and still to come on our program, the secret plans in the mid-1970s to, quote, smash and clobber Cuba. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. There are no official diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba, and there haven't been any for more than a half century, but there have been negotiations through the years between the two governments, and there have been military plans drawn up. Thanks to President Nixon's Oval Office recordings, we have this moment back in March of 1971 at a meeting with President Nixon and CIA Director Richard Helms. President Nixon is asking his top spy, should we start being nice to Castro? Helms, the CIA director here, says he remains opposed to the idea of relenting on Cuba. Helms tells President Nixon after the election of a Marxist government in Chile in 1970, he's advising keep a tough line on Cuba and not give the impression that the U.S. is now soft on Cuba. This was back in 1971. Now, Henry Kissinger was at that meeting as Nixon's national security advisor. 4 years later, there was a new president, and Kissinger was Secretary of State. And we're learning this week Kissinger was pushing to normalize relations with Cuba just 4 years later after that meeting, and went so far as to have a senior State Department official hold a three-hour face-to-face negotiation with a senior Cuban diplomat. Less than a year later, Kissinger reversed and was asking for a classified plan to launch airstrikes against Cuba. William Leogrand, professor of government at American University and co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, joins us here on the Florida Roundup, along with Laura Wise-Munoz with the Associated Press, Tim Padgett with WLRN, and Francis Robles with the New York Times. Professor Leogrand, how close did the U.S. government get in 1975, 1976 to repeating the 13 days in October from 1962?
Well, you know, if these contingency plans that Kissinger had drawn up had been carried out, it would have involved attacking Cuba, either airstrikes and or laying mines in the harbor, blockading the island. And that would have been a violation of the agreement we had with the Soviet Union from the missile crisis in 1962, in which we promised not to attack Cuba in exchange for the Soviets withdrawing their missiles. So there's no doubt it would have provoked a very serious crisis in Soviet-U.S. relations.
Francis Robles, how surprising was this acknowledgement of these military plans, confidential for so many years?
Well, it's funny. The big reaction that I got on Twitter from a lot of readers was, oh, yeah, everybody knew that, except that they didn't.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, you know, it's surprising and it isn't. I mean, not surprising in the terms of who was Henry Kissinger and the role that he played in global politics of that era. But at the end of the day, we didn't know about this. This is very important. And the other thing that's really surprising to me was how much of these documents show that so much of the conversation hasn't changed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much, and then they talk about, oh, one of the measures that we can do is keep the Cuban diplomats from traveling more than 25 miles. And I thought, oh, for crying out loud, we're still having that conversation.
Yeah, and Professor Leo Grand, one of the other things that struck me was even during the three-hour negotiation detailed in this previously confidential secret memo that's included in the book, there was conversation about increasing family travel between the United States and right. Cuba. Again, right from the playbook that we've seen contemporaneously from the Obama administration within the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, that's exactly right. A lot of these bilateral issues haven't changed much over the years. You know, we've had ups and downs where family travel is increased or cut back, depending upon who's in the White House and what their strategy towards Cuba is. But the issues are pretty enduring. And the interesting thing is that, you know, we've been willing to talk with the Cubans. Every president has had some sort of negotiation with Cuba since 1959. And very often we've been able to make some progress on some of these issues.
Professor, I'll ask you to back away from your microphone just a little bit. It's a little too loud here for us down in Miami. But Professor Bill Leo Grand, Professor of Government and American History, new book is Back Channel to Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson, Francis Robles with the New York Times, Laura Wides Munoz with the Associated Press, and Tim Padgett is along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Tim, what struck you about this publication of these memos and these secret meetings and these back channel negotiations that have been ongoing for better part of 40-some years?
Well, as Francis points out, at first glance, it's not that surprising because back in the early 70s, you know, people forget that the Nixon administration détente with, you know, the Soviet Union was the buzzword. You know, he was engaging China, he was engaging the Soviet Union on nuclear arms. So in a way, it makes sense that you would look at the Western Hemisphere and say, why don't we do the same thing with, you know, with its sure. main satellite here? But what that brings us to then is, you know, how do we deal with Cuba then post Cold War? And you know, what we're looking at in the early 1970s is another planet, really, in terms of U.S.-Cuba relations. In that sense, in terms of what we're dealing with now. So in one way it's very helpful. In other ways, though, it reminds you of just how much things have changed since the end of the Cold War and how we have to deal with this situation.
Yeah, Professor, I want to ask you about that change, but back to that 1970s flavor. I mean, that piece of audio tape from the Nixon Oval Office in 1971, the CIA director Richard Helms is saying, no pacification, do not pacify Cuba at this point. We're very worried. But Tim makes the point, at the time, we're trying to open up relations, better relations with the Soviet Union. Nixon's planning to, you know, laying the groundwork to go to China and open up China to the Western world. But yet in 1976, then, as Francis details in the New York Times and you detail in the book, we have military plans. What changed in those 4 or 5 years?
Well, of course, President Nixon always had it in for Fidel Castro, and he told Kissinger at one point he didn't want to hear any more talk about the possibility of improving relations. But once President Ford came in, Kissinger did take the initiative to extend the idea of détente to trying to engage Cuba. And talks went on for the better part of a year and a half moving in that direction. But then the Cubans intervened in the Angolan Civil War to protect the MPLA government from the invasion of South African troops. And that just angered Kissinger enormously. Here he had held out the olive branch of détente to Fidel Castro, and Castro effectively pushed it aside, sent troops to Africa instead.
And Laura, hanging over all of this back in the 70s and these memos and even today, of course, is the Cuban refusal to officially engage without any change in the embargo that has been in place for 50 some years.
Right. There is that. But I also, just getting back to the 70s, you have to remember there was a direct Florida connection. You had exiles who were in Angola advising the armies that were fighting the Angolan government then. And so we definitely were engaged and involved and took it very seriously what was happening there. So in that sense, you know, it is surprising and it isn't. Flashing forward, you know, there has been the repeated sort of playbook where the U.S., you know, offers an olive branch, and just at the last minute, you know, the Cuban government does something that makes it impossible in terms of public relations for us to really engage.
Well, and also reminds us, who's the biggest fan of the Cuban embargo? The Castro brothers.
The Cuban,
that's often the argument, because it gives them a scapegoat for their human rights abuses and economic blunders.
Yeah. Let's bring this Francis Robles with the New York Times into today's through the lens from what you wrote about in the Times this week with the professors writing, the lens to the relationship today as we look forward to next year. There's the opportunity perhaps of President Obama on the same stage with a Castro at this Summit of the Americas in Panama. This would be, you know, a sitting U.S. administration with the sitting Cuban administration at this summit for the first time since the early part of last century.
Again, I go back to what I said before, is that I feel like I'm in a time warp here. You know, I feel like, you know, I covered Cuba for about 6 years for the Miami Herald. And I feel like we've been having the same conversation over and over again. I remember even telling the story once on the show that I was doing research for an article about, I don't know, I think it was changes in the church in Cuba. And as I was doing research, I found a headline from like 1965 that was exactly the story that I was about to write. So, you know, I don't mean to be dismissive of what's going to happen at the summit, but, you know, I'm kind of rolling my eyes here. But I don't want to lose the opportunity to tell your listeners that if they're fascinated by this topic, to look up the documents. They're on the National Security Archive website.
Yeah.
They're really cool. I mean, they say all sorts of interesting things, and there's transcripts of the conversations between Kissinger and Ford, and you could read where Kissinger says things like, I think sooner or later we're going to have to crack the Cubans, and outlining a lot of very detailed military plans in terms of how many squadrons are they going to need, how many aircraft are they going to use, how will they mine these ports, and it's fascinating reading.
Yeah, Professor, one of the things you go away with when you do read this is it wasn't blue sky, pie in the sky, what if. You know, what Secretary of State Kissinger was asking for and what he received from his advisors were detailed military plans, as you mentioned, mines in the water, in the harbor. I mean, this was not a theoretical war game at the case. This was drawing up real military activity with the real potential of activity in this hemisphere, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. And I think it went beyond just contingency planning, because if you look at the way Kissinger talks to President Ford about it, he seems to be making the argument to Ford that these plans need to be used. Maybe not until after the next presidential election because of the political fallout. But he says at one point, I think we'll need to smash the Cubans, but we may have to wait till after the election. And President Ford says, I agree.
And Professor, this is Tim Padgett. One of the things I wanted to ask you on these lines was, you know, as Latin Americans and their leaders look at these documents, how much more of an argument does that give them to back Cuba in terms of things like, you know, allowing Cuba to take part in next year's Summit of the Americas? Because these sort of things bear them out when they say Cuba is a symbol for us in terms of the way the United States has always tried to sort of, you know, roughneck us in this hemisphere.
Well, I think that's exactly why Cuba is an issue for the rest of Latin America. It is the symbolic holdover of a bygone era of U.S. hegemony in the hemisphere, one that Latin American leaders want to see put behind us. President Obama has said from the very beginning of his administration that he wanted a new and equal partnership with the hemisphere. But until we make some progress on the Cuba issue, I don't think Latin American presidents really believe us. And that's why the upcoming summit is so interesting and potentially symbolic in itself, if President Obama and President Castro sit down at the same table together.
Tim, you just sat down with the Latin American leader, President Santos of Colombia. You think he feels that way?
Exactly. And I think he does. If one thing came out in my interview with President Santos, it was that distinction between the way the U.S. looks at Cuba and the way Latin America looks at communist Cuba. There is a disconnect there that may never be connected, because while leaders like Santos are troubled by the fact that Cuba, you know, is not democratic, what matters to them more is that symbolism that Professor Leo Grant was just talking about. This, you know, that for half a century, right or wrong, it's represented this notion of sovereignty for Latin America and the defiance of U.S. hegemony in the region. And that's something that I don't know if, you know, if Washington still really gets today.
That was the debate back in 1975, 1976 with Cuba sending the troops to Angola as well.
Well, I was just going to say, although interestingly enough, what are we actually talking about? We're talking about Cuba sending its troops halfway around the world to Angola. So we're not really talking about sovereignty you know, in this hemisphere. Right, right. They were actually right, going right. to help
to defend an ideology that they believed in.
In across. So yeah. I think that, you know, it doesn't quite fit the narrative.
It's very Cold War stuff.
Right. Yeah. But I will say one other aspect that we haven't really discussed is that, you know, eventually people will change the course of history just with their own movement. You know, the number of Cubans is vastly growing each year coming into Florida. That is going to change the story whether Obama and the Castros
want to. How do you think? Because back to Francis's point, that's a headline we've seen as well for 40 some odd years about Cubans taking to homemade rafts. And
but they're not taking to homemade rafts, and they're getting permission to leave, and it is
increasingly they're getting permission
right,
to leave, but they're still taking homemade rafts as well. Yeah,
they're taking homemade rafts that, you know, right, but they are coming in greater numbers every day, and that is much above what it has been in recent years. And at a certain point, it does begin to shift. It will force us to shift our policies. And you've heard that even from elected officials like Marco Rubio.
Right. Francis, how about it? I mean, we've heard about more engagement with Cuba. We've seen some Cuban entrepreneurs coming here into South Florida and being mentored by South Florida business folks, taking some of that knowledge presumably back to their businesses in Cuba. So, you know, to your point about we've seen this song and dance quite often, do you sense any changes around the edges?
I don't. What I sense is a return, really, back to where I think a lot of the people in Cuba are starting to lose hope. I think that there was a real sense of inspiration when Fidel Castro stepped down. And think about it, you know, that was almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I thought about it this morning. I thought, oh my God, that was 10 years ago. Yeah. And so I think we're just at that point where the people are turning the corner and saying, you know what, let's go back to 2005. This is the same. You know, this is things haven't changed here. And I think I agree with you that I don't know that it makes that much of a difference how many people are coming here. I mean, huge groups came in 1980, a huge group came. I covered the Cuban rafter crisis in 1994. Mm-hmm. I saw it with my own eyes, thousands of people arriving in the sea. And what happened? I mean, a few things changed. But in the end, as much as the small things change, there's going to be some, we need some, there needs to be some bigger break. And Fidel Castro getting sick and stepping down wasn't it.
Professor Leo Grande, I'm curious, just the takeaway for the next administration in 2016, if that administration goes back through those history archives that you detail in your book, how does that inform the next administration's engagement with Cuba, do you think?
I think we've got an opportunity here where leaders in both Havana and in Washington understand that the relationship as it's been frozen for the last 50 years doesn't really make a lot of sense for either country anymore. President Obama has said that a couple of times already. Hillary Clinton, even before she declares her candidacy, has said that she doesn't think the embargo is working anymore, doesn't think it makes sense. Raul Castro has offered negotiations with the United States repeatedly, and I think there's a difference between Raul and Fidel when it comes to beating up on the United States. Fidel Castro made a political career of being David in conflict with Goliath. Raul Castro hasn't really used that rhetorical jibe nearly as much. He's really focused a lot more on the problems of Cuba domestically and trying to sort those out before the revolutionary generation passes from the scene. And normalizing relations with the United States would be a big step in a positive direction from the point of view of the Cuban economy.
But Tim, what does that look like, that normalization? Because in the memos from 1975, they talk about travel visas and cultural exchanges. But the Cubans were steadfast again. Without change on the embargo, a full normalization can't be had.
Well, and the moderates on Cuba policy today would say there is a way to go in that direction without looking like we're capitulating to the Cubans on the embargo. And one of those ways is, you mentioned before, entrepreneurs. They argue we could loosen the embargo just enough so that we could allow American investors to channel credit, capital, expertise, equipment, et cetera, to those independent entrepreneurs and small business people in Cuba in ways that would empower them without, you know, looking like we're just dropping the embargo for Raul.
And then the other aspect, I think almost more symbolically, but maybe perhaps equally important, is the designation as a state sponsor of terror, which is just, I think, long been sort of a sort of moral and emotional affront to the state as well as a practical.
Yeah, and a lot of people say that if we were just to make that gesture, it would just go that. A long way toward getting Alan Gross released, the U.S. contractor who's now behind bars.
Right, he's being accused of a spy in Cuba, but the U.S. contends he was selling telecommunications equipment. Francis, what say you to that next administration and how they could be informed by what was going on back in the mid-1970s that we learned about today, or learned about this week?
Oh, as a representative of the New York Times, I decline to inform the next administration.
Francis Roebling's a representative of the New York Times. Finally, I just have to ask Professor Billy Ogrande of American University, this book, Back Channel to Cuba. You detail these meetings, and we talk about the big philosophy here, this political ideology, you know, years and years of friction, military planning, these kind of grand ideas. But these meetings, these back channel meetings that you detail in the book, there's something human about them. They still are happening at the human scale. 3-hour meeting at a New York Midtown hotel, or a meeting in a cafe in an airport. There was still something almost approachable about this that I think may surprise people, that these are still, you know, these are still humans trying to deal with these big ideas. What struck you about kind of the scale of these secret negotiations?
You know, I think you've really hit upon something important. For many years, the same negotiators were talking with one another, particularly through the Reagan years and the Clinton years. And the negotiators on the two sides, all professionals, nevertheless came to have a certain personal affection for one another, and they went out of their way to do very nice human things for one another, recognizing one another's birthdays and joking sometimes about some of the differences between the two countries. It was a real reminder for me, reading the transcripts of all these meetings, that at the end of the day, it's human beings on both sides, and the governments have antagonisms. There are real issues that divide us from Cuba, obviously. But at the end of the day, it's people, and hopefully one can keep that humanity in mind as we try to figure out how to finally build reconciliation between the two countries.
Bill Leogrand, professor of government at American University, co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, along with us here on the Florida Roundup, along with Tim Padgett with WLRN and Francis Robles with the New York Times. Tom Hudson, that's me, Laura Wides-Munoz with the Associated Press. We will continue. We got plenty more to come on our program, Raising the Risk from Higher Seas, but will attention turn into action? That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It's an astronomical event that occurs about once every 5 or 6 months. The Earth slips right between the moon and the sun, creating a lunar eclipse, and can bring high waters to low-lying South Florida, even if the forecast is for dry weather. One of these so-called king tides is due to happen next Thursday, less than a week after local leaders met on Miami Beach to discuss their efforts to stay dry at the 6th annual Southeast Florida Climate Change Leadership Summit. Here's Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine.
And it's not uncommon to see parked cars inundated by quickly rising floodwaters, pedestrians walking barefoot through knee-high waters, or even property flooding on a day full of sunshine.
Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez announced he's assembling a board of business, finance, and insurance leaders to start planning.
To begin defining the steps needed to effectively incorporate consideration of sea level rise impacts into the planning and infrastructure project.
Now, local efforts have the attention of federal policymakers. Mike Boots is the acting chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. He was at the summit this week on Miami Beach, encouraging more local leadership.
The president knows well that the best ideas on this do not come from inside the Beltway. Calling on governors and mayors and county officials and tribal leaders to give to us their recommendations for how the federal government can modernize the way we tackle this problem.
How does this attention, though, turn into action? Where are state and federal leaders? Where's the business community? There's plenty at risk there, right? How concerned are you about higher seas? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9500. 1-800-743-5576, 1-800-743-WLRN, on Facebook and on Twitter at WLRN. Laura Wides-Munoz with the Associated Press along with us, Jenny Siladovich with the Miami Herald, and Luisa Yanez with the Miami Herald also along with us here. This summit, Jenny, was the result of a pact between four Southeast Florida counties, Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe, to work together on climate change and sea level rise. The sixth annual summit, what's the result? What's the takeaway?
They are still planning, the ongoing planning. However, they feel like they're making progress in the sense that everybody is accepting climate change now. And while they still feel like they need to continue laying the groundwork, they're trying to come up with tangible steps to take. 2 years ago, they came up with the 110 action items right. that they've been working on. So at the conference this week, they went down and gave some examples of some concrete things that they've done. Miami-Dade County has passed a resolution saying that resiliency needs to be incorporated in all capital improvement projects. They felt like that was a big step. There are some others. We've got Miami Beach will test out its new pumps on October 9th.
Yeah, these are the Alton Road. Yeah, sure.
Correct. So, and then the city of Miami has also agreed to spend about $4 million on energy efficiency and renewables. Broward County has agreed.
Yeah. So there are some points, there are some takeaways, some progress to report here after 6 years. Luisa, I'm wondering though, the public engagement here, some local engagement that Jenny details. What about the state and national leaders on this issue?
Well, I think, we have a governor who is not totally convinced on the impact of climate change, but South Florida is ground zero for a visual look at what really happens during these rising waters. I mean, anybody who's been to Miami Beach during king tides, it's unexplainable how, there's salt water on the streets. Mm-hmm. So I think nationally, the president is on board. Locally, I think in recent years, we've really stepped up our concern about rising waters, especially. And in Tallahassee, I think, that's still more to come. Bill Nelson, our senator, is very involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he's invited some other senators to come and see how what happens during king tides, which is it's hard to explain to other people who don't live in this area.
Yeah, be sure to bring your boots and keep your car parked on the second floor, I think, are the rules there. The summit participants here, Laura Wides-Munoz with the AP, it was interesting. Nobody from the state government of Florida was involved in this summit. There was somebody from state government of Vermont who was there.
I think it's incredible. I did a story on Miami's growth, the technology hub, for U.S. Latin relations. And I met this company, a French group, a French guy, who's starting a solar panel, international global company. And he's using Florida as a base to sell to Europe and Latin America. He says he's getting nothing, to sell in Florida. There's just no interest in, you don't have to have
Jenny.
Huge brain to realize.
Well, yesterday I went out with Mike Boots from the White House and Kristen Jacobs, who's sort of played a leading role in this whole climate, and she was saying that there seems to be movement on the bottom and the top, but the middle is stuck. They're not just the middle being the state is not.
And what's interesting is that it seems like at least the Charlie Crist campaign is sort of banking on this as an issue to get out the youth vote. I don't know how successful that will be, really, but it will be interesting to see whether that is an area that, youth really do engage in here in Florida. I know they do elsewhere, but it'll be interesting to see if that gets folks to the polls.
See how well environment plays here. There's been really very little discussion of it from either campaign. Political Action Committee called Next Gen Climate, though, has taken aim at Governor Scott.
In a world where the sea is rising, one state finds itself in great peril. Leadership is nowhere to be found. After years of denying the science of climate change, one man can only produce age-old solutions. To save the powerful friends who bankroll his campaign, Rick Scott has built an ark.
scary voiceover, scary music and all. This is a Political Action Committee online ad funded by California billionaire Tom Steyer. Now, there is a real arc from this group. It's only 22 feet long, Jenny. It's touring Florida ahead of this election. But where is the environment in this campaign?
Well, Amendment 1 is on the ballot, that was something that was pushed by an environmentalist around the state, and that's gained some traction in response. Rick Scott launched his own Keeping Florida Beautiful $1 billion over 10 years.
Amendment 1 would apply state money to preserve Florida land.
It would take 30% of dock stamp tax on real estate deals, money that was traditionally used to fund conservation efforts. But in the last 4 years, the legislature has not devoted that money. So what the environmentalists say is we're just sort of restoring what was there traditionally.
Yeah.
No new tax, but it does take 33% of money that some people say, you know, this should be spent on other items.
Luisa Yanez with the Miami Herald editorial board. You wrote in a op-ed piece this week, the compact members should emerge from the Miami Beach Convention Center full of cohesive ideas on how to keep our region afloat. Are you confident that came out?
Well, I think they had more questions than solutions. And that's the thing with this issue. You know, it's hard to nail down what to do. I think the idea, though, of working together, because this is an issue that it's got to be regional. You can't have, you know, sometimes Dade will do what they want and Broward will do what they want. But in this case, I think we have to come together because it impacts all of us and it's got to be a united front. For example, I know the city of Miami Beach is you know, they're ahead of everybody else. They have their, like Jenny said, they have their pumps ready for next week. But I think unity is the thing we tried to get across in our editorial. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, I think that's, you know, there were 650 people at this conference. I think there's some of that going on, and that's what's needed.
And it came, of course, a week or so after the United Nations Global Climate Change Conference, Jenny, that had hundreds of thousands of people marching in New York City, engaged with hundreds of global leaders. But a lot of the resistance that you'll hear in the United States in terms of signing on to some kind of global pact regarding climate change is, where are the two biggest polluters? Where's India? Where's China in all of this? And they're not fully engaged in this. Arguably, you could say we've got local folks here in Florida, national folks engaged, maybe the state not so much. Globally, two big polluters not engaged in this conversation either.
Right, right. And I think, though, that the people who are engaged say, well, eventually maybe they'll catch up. But you're right. It's they're not.
Well, I think there are two things. I mean, one is I have read more recently that with the smog levels so bad in China, they are being forced to confront the issues. I think there's a sense with the environment, maybe more than almost anything else, that the problem is so great and so overwhelming, it's better to bury your head in the sand. And I think that that's a challenge for environmentalists to really, you know, out of this summit, to, you know, here are some 10 specific things that we can do if we pull together, that the state can do that could make a difference.
Right.
And really spell that out both for state lawmakers and for residents.
Yeah, Luisa, that's really one of the things that this conference has done through the 6 years is try to make those real life connections and try to discuss that, yes, this is a long-range, slow-moving disaster, but there are some very real implications even today. And this year, it seemed like the business community got engaged in a pretty significant way, don't you think?
Yes, and I think they're highly impacted, especially on Miami Beach. I mean, every time Alton Road, I mean, the floods will go up to Alton Road, and all those businesses, all those merchants have to close down. I mean, people are not going to tread through all that water. So I think they're beginning to realize that this is a financial, will have a severe financial impact on cities like Miami Beach. And also up in Fort Lauderdale, A1A, that
right.
floods right there where the boys are, that spot is, you know, during King Tides, that's flooded.
Yep. You got your boots ready for King Tide Day, Jenny?
Yes.
Laura, you'll be...
Or I'll be on a boat.
well away from the beach, I imagine, right? Jenny Stiladovic covering the environment for the Miami Herald, Luisa Yanez with the Miami Herald editorial board, and Laura Wides Munoz here for the full hour with the Associated Press. Thank you to all three of you here for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Finally, on the Roundup here today, we would like to remind you, we'll be kind here and remind you of Friday's date.
On October 3rd, he asked me what day it was.
It's October 3rd.
So, thanks to the movie Mean Girls, October 3rd has become, at least unofficially, Mean Girls Day.
That is so fetch. Gretchen, stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going to happen.
Gretchen has been trying for 10 years to make Fetch a thing, and she hasn't happened. Mean Girls, the movie, turns 10 years old, certainly a launching point for many a famous actress at this point. It is Happy Mean Girls Day today, and we tell you this to be nice to one another. It's also the Jewish New Year, so Happy New Year. Tomorrow is Yom Kippur. For those of you who are fasting, be sure to have an easy fast. The program is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Technical supervision by Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Hey, here she comes now.